global beats. And you're on that sandy plate, trying to blow back a summer heat, holding out for better ways.
From WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, this is Johannes Varno with your WSLR News headlines for Wednesday, February 19th. A survey by the University of North Florida of 870 voters seems to hint that what's popular among DeSantis and Trump supporters isn't necessarily popular among Floridians in general. The name change of the Gulf of Mexico to Gulf of America is supported by only 42%. The state's 6-week abortion ban is supported by just 44%. And only 33% do not like the idea of legalizing marijuana. Meanwhile, Republican state legislators continue to crank out bills for the upcoming session that would limit local decision-making. A state senator from Fort Myers wants the legislature to fund a study about ending property taxes and compensating for the resulting drop in revenues with sales taxes and budget cuts. Taxes on homes and commercial buildings are playing a major role in funding schools and local government. Another bill, this one has a Senate and House version, would impose term limits on all school board members and county commissioners in Florida. Yet another bill, sponsored by a representative from St. Petersburg, would ban cities and counties from funding public art with developer fees. With Governor Ron DeSantis describing him as a bulldog and saying he has, quote, the proper worldview, James Uthmeyer was ceremonially introduced as Florida's next attorney general yesterday. Uthmeyer was the governor's chief of staff, and before that, he led DeSantis' presidential campaign. He's replacing Ashley Moody, who was appointed to the U.S. Senate by DeSantis. Uthmeyer will serve until the end of Moody's current term in 2026. Here's what he said during the ceremony. Quote, "We will not stand idly by as the left tries to infiltrate our institutions and use the court system to indoctrinate our kids. We will fight the activists that try to weaken our duly enacted laws, that try to challenge our constitutional order, and try to harm the unborn." Unquote. If you live in Parrish, you may save a minute or two in your commute soon. Two new ramps that cross the Manatee River along I-75 will open on Thursday and Friday. They're part of an upgrade to the Interstate 75 interchange with US 301 that is slated for completion this year. This has been Johannes Varner with your WSLR News headlines for Wednesday, February 19th.
Good morning. Good morning. This is Tom Walker. This is the Peace and Justice Report. Every Wednesday at 9 o'clock, Bob Connors and I alternate, and today is me, and I've got a great program for you. Remember that the opinions you hear on this show, of course, are ours and ours alone, and not necessarily those of WSLR, its employees, board, or volunteers. This is an interview I did about yesterday with a very famous author, and I think you'll enjoy it. It's about 45 minutes long. I'll introduce him on this video. So here we, this audio, hold on, here we go, going in, and let me play it for you. Here we go, music. Now it's coming.
Our guest today is Sasha Abramski. Sasha was born in England in 1972, grew up in London, and studied politics, philosophy, and economics at Oxford. He got his BA in 1993 and moved to New York after in order to study journalism at the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. He moved to California in 2003 and lives there now with his wife and two kids. He is the Western correspondent for The Nation magazine and the author of 10 books. The latest book came out last year and is titled Chaos Comes Calling, The Battle Against the Far-Right Takeover of Small Town America. So welcome, Sasha. Thanks for being here.
Tom, it's good to be on the show.
Yeah, we met on the Nation Magazine cruise last December. That's an annual trip the Nation Magazine sponsors. And the highlights are the many, many panel discussions of all sorts of topics led by the writers at the Nation and other celebrities. So it's a wonderful thing I want to suggest to our listeners if they can make it. So, Sasha, please tell us about your new book, Chaos Comes Calling, The Battle Against the Far-Right Takeover of Small Town America.
Okay, so I have been writing on Trump and sort of everything to do with the alt-right and the hard right for at least 10 years now. Nation put me onto the Trump beat in 2015 when he came down the escalator and announced that he was running as a candidate. And one of the things that interested me right from the get-go was the way they used language and the way that they reimagined language as a political battering ram. And they did it by coarsening the language, by oversimplifying. They did it by sort of taking out nuance from politics. And that has consequences. And it has consequences nationally. We're seeing, you know, the ultimate form of chaos unfolding now in 2024. But before we got to 2024, we had a whole bunch of other things. So, of course, we had the first Trump presidency. We had the COVID pandemic. And we had the rise of social media and the fracturing of the ways that we got news and the way that we transmitted information. And all of these were sort of triggers for chaos. That if you wanted to go into a local community and see what was happening, years ago.
So did you analyze the process by which they gradually took over?
It looks like we weren't plugged in, so we're going to start again and give it another try.
Was it
all four by the counties in this area?
Here we go.
Our guest today is Sasha Abramski. Sasha was born in England in 1972, grew up in London, and studied politics, philosophy, and economics at Oxford. He got his BA in 1993 and moved to New York after in order to study journalism at the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. He moved to California in 2003 and lives there now with his wife and two kids. He is the Western correspondent for The Nation magazine and the author of 10 books. The latest book came out last year and is titled Chaos Comes Calling: The Battle Against the Far-Right Takeover of Small-Town America. So welcome, Sasha. Thanks for being here.
Tom, it's good to be on the show.
Yeah, we met on the Nation magazine cruise last December. That's an annual trip the Nation magazine sponsors. And the highlights are the many, many panel discussions of all sorts of topics led by the writers at the Nation and other celebrities. So it's a wonderful thing I want to suggest to our listeners if they can make it. So, Sasha, please tell us about your new book, Chaos Comes Calling: The Battle Against the Far-Right Takeover of Small-Town America.
Okay, so I have been writing on Trump and sort of everything to do with the outright and the hard right for at least 10 years now. Nation put me onto the Trump beat in 2015 when he came down the escalator and announced that he was running as a candidate. And one of the things that interested me right from the get-go was the way they used language and the way that they reimagined language as a political battering ram. And they did it by coarsening the language, by oversimplifying. They did it by sort of taking out nuance from politics. And that has consequences. And it has consequences nationally. We're seeing, you know, the ultimate form of chaos unfolding now in 2024. But before we got to 2024, we had a whole bunch of other things. So, of course, we had the first Trump presidency. We had the COVID pandemic. And we had the rise of social media and the fracturing of the ways that we got news and the way that we transmitted information. And all of these were sort of triggers for chaos. That if you wanted to go into a local community and see what was happening, and you had these local sort of Trump wannabes at the local level, and then you had all of this misinformation flowing around COVID, flowing around diversity, flowing around abortion, you know, all these trigger issues in the cultural wars where there's this sort of tsunami of misinformation. One of the things that interested me was at the local level, what's the impact of all that? So I focused my book on two communities. One of them is in Northern California. It's called Shasta County. Very, very far-right community that got even more far-right during the pandemic. And the other is a community up on the Olympic Peninsula in Washington State, small county called Clallam County. And Clallam was a bellwether county. It was one of the only rural counties that, from the Reagan period onwards, voted for the winning presidential candidate every election. It actually broke that in 2024 because it voted for Harris. But until then, it was one of the only bellwether counties in the country. But it had also had this jag rightward in many of its small cities during the COVID crisis. And I got really interested in this. What does it mean when you have lynch mobs outside public health officers' places of work? What does it mean when you have these massive online trolling operations designed to intimidate, harass, scare political opponents? What does it mean when death threats become normalized in the political context? What does it mean when men and women start bringing long-armed guns to political protests? You know, really, really bad things start happening. And the other really bad thing that started happening, especially in Shasta County, which I think is prescient given what's going on now federally, is they started firing people left, right, and center. They started firing public health workers. They started disinvesting in community health infrastructure. They started firing people they thought were involved in diversity programs. All the things that we're seeing in Washington now, led by DOGE, you could see in these small communities around America a year, wow, two, three ago. And to me, it was fascinating. And so I wrote this book, Chaos Comes Calling. You know, I didn't really know. I was hoping desperately when I wrote it that I was writing about a moment that we had sort of transcended nationally. And obviously, we haven't. We've dived fully into it, and we're in as chaotic and dangerous a moment probably as we've been in this country since the American Civil War. So, you know, I think the book is probably more relevant today than it was when I started writing it 2 years ago, 3 years ago.
So did you analyze the process by which they gradually took over? Was it all activism, or was it all misinformation? Or I know you talked a lot about social media. How do you think this happens in some towns and not others? In other words, what's the process?
I think it's activism layered on misinformation. And one of the things you saw was people in these small communities who were sort of maybe passively conservative prior to COVID. COVID mm-hmm. comes in, the lockdowns come in, the public health mandates come in, and suddenly a whole bunch of people get activated and they feel it's a real intrusion. Their churches are shut, their in-person worship's closed down, their children are off school, their businesses, if they're non-essential, are shut. And a lot of people get very, very angry. And some of that is justified anger. A lot of the, you know, as far as I'm concerned, a lot of the COVID response with hindsight, in hindsight's 2020 is everything, but with hindsight, some of the COVID response responses, especially around closing schools, were counterproductive. And so some of the anger I understand, but the way it was channeled was this sort of bizarre zag rightward. So you had a lot of people who in a different era and a different geographic location might have moved towards the new left, people who a generation ago would have been anti-war activists in the Vietnam War, two generations ago, anti-war activists. They may have been suspicious of vaccines and big pharma. Well, that was, you know, a lot of that was the new left positions. But in the current context, it was the new right that grabbed them, politicized them, and gave them what they needed around vaccines and what they needed around, you know, the horrors of lockdown mandates or whatever they wanted to call it. But it also gave them an outright ideology. So it gave them this anti-woke ideology. It gave them, or what they call an anti-woke ideology. It gave them Christian nationalism. It gave them this, you know, total sort of legitimation to be suspicious of diversity and everything else. And we're seeing the consequences now, and they're horrific. They're a stripping of many of the ideals that have made America a great country over, you know, many, many decades, if not centuries. And we're seeing it on steroids, sort of turbocharged on steroids with Trump's rhetoric and with Elon Musk's rhetoric. We're seeing it when J.D. Vance goes to Europe and lectures social democracies because they're not cozying up to far-right neo-Nazi parties. I mean, this is a sort of Alice in Wonderland world where American leaders go to Europe and demand that Europe shows more sympathy to neo-Nazis. It's completely horrific. But that's where we are at this moment. And in large part, I think it's because of the chaos that was unleashed in the Trump era and in the COVID era.
Yeah, and then they wanted to do something. They felt trapped and passive, and to take action by saying no, yes, no, you can't do this to us. It was kind of a call to action and brought people together in a negative way.
But let me add in one more thing, Tom. It was a call to action, but the thing that I found so fascinating when I was reporting the book was, in some ways, it was a rejection of a sort of austerity politics.
Yes.
A moral austerity politics. You can't laugh at this joke. You can't call people by this name. You can't go out and socialize because we've got a lockdown. Now, you know, the interesting thing is, if you go back to the 1960s, one reason the left-wing counterculture was so successful was it appropriated the language and the actions of sort of irreverence. So if you look at someone like Abby Hoffman, the leader of the Yippies, you know, it was a sort of anarchist politics that was deliberately irreverent and countercultural. Yes. Well, if you fast forward to the 2010s and especially the 2020s, in some malign mutation, it's the outright that became irreverent. And so people who said, well, I want to be able to laugh at this joke without feeling guilty. I want to be able to, you know, say this without feeling guilty. And I want to be able to go out and have a beer with my friends despite the COVID lockdown without feeling guilty. Suddenly, somehow, they glommed onto the authoritarian right. And it's weird. And I think it's going to take, you know, decades to sort of fully untangle all of that. And I'm sure the historians will eventually have a field day with it. But I think it's undeniable.
They became active instead of passive. They can't do this to me, kind of. I'm not going to sit still and take this.
That's right. I'm mad as hell. I'm not going to take it anymore, as the guy says in the film Network. And yeah. Then somehow they went from that to saying, all right, I'm going to embrace the most, you know, crazy outright theories of life.
Now, and that lasted a year or two in both the communities, right? But I understand one of them came back slightly more to the center. And one did not. And which one was which, and why was that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, again, without sort of spoiling the ending, because I do want people to rush out and buy the book. But no, I will say this. You're right that there are two different trajectories. One of the counties that I focused on, the one in Washington, organized. People said, you know what, this is crazy. Our government's become dysfunctional. We've become a sort of laughing stock. We've got to find out a way to do things better. And they organized. They formed a good governance league. They canvassed. They educated people. And they did the old-fashioned sort of political grunt work, and it was successful. The other county didn't have that kind of grassroots pushback, and it just swung further and further rightward. And so you got sort of kookier and kookier politics coming out of Shasta County. And I ask a question in the book. I'm like, look, this is, you know, to coin a Doge phrase, this is a fork in the road moment. Which fork is America going to choose? Are we going to go down the road of recalibrating back to the middle, or are we going to go off on this dysfunctional, chaotic, cruel jag rightward? Well, unfortunately, November 2024 answered that. In the short term, anyway, America chose to go on this jag rightward, which really made no sense. If you looked at the individual policies, America didn't support destroying our environmental infrastructure. Americans didn't support, you know, really authoritarian moves against abortion. Americans didn't support rolling back the Affordable Care Act. Americans don't support rolling back food stamps. On issue after issue after issue, if you really parse it, Americans are out of sympathy with Trump and with Musk and with their agenda. But somehow, in a fit of absence of mind, 80 million people in their wisdom decided that because Trump was promising them cheaper eggs and cheaper gas, both of which turned out to be an illusion, they would forget about the fact that his closest advisors were calling him a fascist and they would elect him back into office. And I think it's a historical calamity. Now, whether or not America has the strength to pull itself out from the hole we've dug for ourselves, that I don't know. But I do think in a fit of absence of mind, we created an absolute historical disaster.
You know, I saw some of this same strange thinking when I was in the farmer's market for Bernie when he was running. And I would have Trumpers come up to me and they would say, I love Trump, but I love Bernie too. And why did they love Bernie? Because he was breaking the mold. They took him for saying the truth as opposed to being, you know, the normal political words and so forth. He broke the mold. He was a strong man, so to speak. Does that make any sense that they would like them both?
It does make sense. I mean, to me, it's obviously weird because I think what made Bernie Sanders an interesting candidate was the fact that he was willing to talk about socialist, social democratic issues in public, and he was unapologetic about it.
Yeah.
But it's certainly true that a lot of people who voted for Bernie Sanders in 2016 or 2020 in the primaries did so because they were anti-establishment. They felt that the system was broken and he would shake things up enough to create a new model, or at least the potential for a new model. And in his own sort of twisted way, Trump offers the same. He says, look, the system's broken, it's riddled with hypocrisy, and I'm going to come in as a strong man and fix it. Well, you know, of course, it's an illusion because Trump's really a grifter at heart.
Yeah,
what Trump cares about is breaking down the guardrails, breaking down the ethics and the inspector general watchdogs that can slow him down, and basically raiding the government. That's what he does. He wants to sort of use his position in power to get people to pay for his businesses. I don't know whether you want to call it a shakedown or whatever you want to call it, but he's basically using an interplay of his political and his business interests to enrich himself. And Musk's doing the same thing. I mean, there's no evidence at all that Musk's really caring about government efficiency. He's, you know, at speed, breaking down systems of government that might serve as guardrails against the expansion of his business interests even further into the government realm. And so we're seeing a sort of corporatism take root where there's this, you know, intensive intertwining of private and public at the very top levels of government. And that's happened before. It's happened in the 1920s with the Teapot Dome scandal, for example. It certainly happened at the city level. You had Tammany Hall in New York, which was one of the most corrupt political machines in history. But in the 20th century, American government, to a by and large degree, cleaned itself up. It created a series of guardrails designed to stop that kind of corruption, created a series of ethics, rules, and regulations designed to disentangle business and public interest. And to a degree, those worked. I mean, no one would say that there weren't some examples of corruption in government, but it wasn't systemic. It wasn't the idea that government was literally for sale to the highest bidder. Now we're returning to what may be a historic or sort of historically normal situation where there's no pretense. Government is just a way that you get power to accumulate more power, and you get power to accumulate more economic interest. Well, that's a shocking rollback to a sort of very grubby, dirty sort of age that we thought we'd put behind us. But it's historically understandable. Trump is a figure not from the future, but from the past in many ways. So I do think, you know, yes, you're right that there's an overlap to a degree between Bernie Sanders and Trump. But had Bernie Sanders been president, it would not have become a kleptocracy. It would have been shaken up, but it would have been shaken up for entirely different reasons. We would have had things like an expansion of access to healthcare, an expansion of access to nutritional programs. Instead, we're going to see one of the biggest rollbacks in government in American history, if not the biggest rollback, all in pursuit of enriching top private interests.
And hopefully people will realize that. And at the midterms, we will have see a different House and Senate.
I think that's true. I think, you know, when the Trump fever breaks, it's going to break extremely explosively, because when people realize they've been conned, you know, they bought into a cult. They have been told, we're going to make you great again. When they realize that making them great again means taking away their and their children's health care, which is going to happen over the coming years, when they realize that making them great again involves raiding food stamps and all the other things that keep them, you know, above the poverty line in times of emergency, when they realize that making America great again quite possibly involves raiding Social Security, yes, at that point, there is going to be a tremendous backlash. I don't know when it will happen, but I do think it will happen.
That's if they know that, if they realize that. And so that brings us to the sources of information. Where do these people, or do they get their information at all? Or is it only from the online services?
You're right.
You read, you know?
I mean, Tom, you're right. It's been a breakdown in the way that we get information for the last couple decades now. So America used to have tens of thousands of newspapers. Yeah. We still got a lot of newspapers, but we got about half as many as we had a generation ago. We still got a lot of journalists, but we got about half as many as we had a generation ago. We're making the few journalists we have left do more with less, and yes, we're increasingly getting rid of print versions of the newspaper and relying on sort of bastardized, truncated online versions, which don't give you nearly as much information and only give you the information that the algorithm says you're going to find of interest. So you sort of immediately lose out on the breadth of knowledge that you get in an, yes, old-fashioned newspaper. That's important. It's important for so many reasons, but especially in this moment, because it means there are a huge number of Americans who are either getting their news from places like Breitbart, One America Network, and Fox, which have become, to all intents and purposes, state media for the far right. Yes. Or they're getting their news from social media rumor mills, which may or may not be accurate, but have no gatekeeper function at all. So you're just as likely to get a story saying that the LA fires were started because people were trying to blow up pedophilia rings under the Palisades, which was a rumor that circulated, as you are to get real news about the fact that the Palisades fire was started because of Hurricane Force Santa Ana winds. So, you know, if you have this breakdown of reality and fiction, if you have this breakdown of accuracy and falsehood, and people don't know which is which and basically just sort of judge it based on whatever they click on, that's a terrible way to get news distributed. And so you're right, it's a real problem that, you know, if you're paying attention, you're reading accurate news sources, you know that what Trump is unleashing is horrific. And you know it's going to have terrible consequences, not just at the abstract level, but in everyday life, in how we go about our lives in America in the 21st century. If you're not getting your news from credible sources at this point, you probably don't realize it, not least because government can run on autopilot for a few weeks or even a few months. You can get rid of a quarter of the staff. Chances are most things will sort of potter along for a little bit, but eventually systems start to break down. You saw this with Elon Musk when he took over Twitter. Yeah, you know, things worked until they didn't. Things worked until you fire so many engineers that suddenly live broadcast break down, or suddenly, you know, one function or another breaks down. The thing is, with Twitter, who cares? You know, if Twitter goes offline for a few hours, so you can't post for a few hours, big deal. If Social Security goes offline for a few weeks, people who are relying on their checks to, you know, pay their bills don't get their money. If federal grants aren't distributed, which they're not being at the moment, federal clinics have to close. Community organizations that do things like drive elderly people to dialysis appointments have to lay off their workers. That's a very, very immediate impact. And I think the more those impacts become clear over time, people are going to realize this is a con job. This is a job that eviscerates government and only enriches certain people in the private sector.
Well, I hope people realize that. I hope and get that kind of message. But you're right. Things could break down. Especially things like medical research, new diseases, so forth, which if they miss one, it'd be devastating. You know,
which is entirely likely given the direction that Robert Kennedy is going to take the public health infrastructure, and given the muzzling regulations that have gone out saying the CDC and NIH can't communicate information about bird flu, for example, with other scientists, and given the fact that we've pulled out of the World Health Organization, so we're not sharing vital global public health data with other countries, that increases the risk that something jumps the shark, that you end up with a really, really bad medical situation that, you know, like with COVID or even worse, impacts millions and millions of people. Yeah. So, you know, it's entirely possible Trump's mad project fails again in the face of a pandemic. And again, it wouldn't be entirely surprising given what they're doing to the public health infrastructure. It wouldn't be a coincidence. It would be that, you know, twice in a row Trump came in, twice in a row he under-resourced deliberately the public health system, and twice in a row he hobbled the ability to communicate with other international and supranational organizations. It's just stupid politics, and it's going to eventually have damage.
You know, and we're doing the same thing abroad. We're alienating our friends and devastating USAID, where we make friends on an informal basis. It's like we're setting out to, well, to be the strong man, to be do it our way or the highway. You know, it's
we are, but you know, the irony is, all it does is makes America weaker. So, in the interest of being strong and showing our power, we're going to cut $66 billion of USAID. Well, $66 billion is less than 1% of the federal budget. It's a drop in the ocean. It is one of the most effective investments that the American government has ever made, not least for two reasons. One, it produces well wishes for America. People respect a country that comes in and helps on hunger, that helps on medical disasters and so on. But the second reason is much more self-interested, which is that if you can deal with emerging diseases overseas, if you can, for example, contain HIV epidemics before HIV mutates, for example, it's way cheaper than waiting until it hits US shores. So, you know, one of the craziest things that I read about in the last few weeks was, in cutting off US aid, the American government stopped providing medical coverage midstream to thousands of people around the world enrolled in US aid medical experiments. Well, first of all, that's vastly medically unethical. But second of all, if you're giving people experimental drugs and then halfway through the program, you just stop giving them those drugs, or you've got people with experimental vaccines and then halfway through you stop delivering the vaccines, you are almost guaranteeing you're going to get drug resistant strains of everything from malaria to tuberculosis. And if that happens, it's going to end up costing first world countries far more than $66 billion to contain it. So it is such a stupid, such a short-sighted measure, and you're right, it's designed to make America look like they've got strongman leadership. It's actually one of the weakest forms of leadership I've ever seen.
And the allies, of course, reacting as you might expect them to. And he's, you know, and we're talking to Russia about settling Ukraine without Ukraine being there, so forth, so forth. I can't predict where that is going. You know.
Oh, I can. It looks remarkably like the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact in 1939 that divvied up Eastern Europe. What we're seeing behind closed doors is America and Russia saying, you know what? Let's talk about spheres of influence. That's what's happening. Russia is basically saying to America, you can come in, you can get your oil companies doing business in Russia again. They said that very explicitly yesterday. And in exchange, we want our old sphere of influence back. And America may not say it in public, but what they're really sort of signaling is, we don't really care so much about Eastern Europe anymore. You want to try your hand at invading a Baltic state? Try it. There's a pretty good chance that we're not going to honor our NATO commitments. Now, again, America's not saying that stuff out loud, but that's the message that's between the lines here, that America is no longer a reliable partner to NATO, and that America regards the European Union as a sort of enemy being, an enemy entity. And this is horrific. The European Union has been the element of stability in Europe for the last 70 years, since the 1950s. And now America is going to sort of informally ally with Russia to destabilize and maybe try and end the existence of the EU. Well, that's horrific. And again, it's so, so short-sighted, because eventually that's going to boomerang back against America with a vengeance.
I wonder why Europe all of a sudden is not a desirable ally, but Russia might be. What's the thinking there? I don't see it.
I think they share, you know, I mean, where Vance wasn't wrong the other day at the security conference is the far right in America, which for some unfathomable reason is now in control of the US government, does have more in common ideologically with Putin. Putin isn't, you know, an heir to the Soviet Union. Putin is an heir to the Russian imperialists.
Yes.
I mean, that's, if you want ideologically to look at Putin, he's backed up by the Russian Orthodox Church, which is extremely conservative. He's backed up by sort of cultural warriors who believe that, you know, LGBTQ gay rights are illegitimate.
Yes.
He's anti-abortion. He believes that, you know, in a very traditional view of a woman's place being in the home. On all of those issues, Vance isn't wrong that America actually is ideologically quite simpatico with that kind of vision.
Yeah.
The tragedy is that those people got anywhere near the levers of power in America, but they are at the levers of power and they're using it quite effectively right now.
So that would explain the similar mindset and philosophy, would explain his sympathy with the other dictators in the Eastern Europe and so forth. Like you say, let's divide it up. You had a quote in one of your essays that I want to read. I thought this was great. Let me see if I can find it now. This was in The Nation magazine, and it was in an article you wrote, which I recommend to people, and I put a link on our front page about where they could find your articles. It was called A Profoundly Un-American Moment, and I love this quote. You said, taken as a whole, this is an unprecedented assault on American society and values, one intended to blow up the country's alliances and its civil fabric, one contemptuous of the political processes of democracy, and all too likely, in the end, to corrode its economic foundations and to replace constitutional government with imperial rule. And so I thought that's a beautiful sentence, and I hope it doesn't come true. So what can we do? What can we, the Democrats? People say the Democrats haven't formulated a strategy yet, or what? And there's lots of advice. What do you think can be done to resist this kind of thing that I just read you talking about?
Well, I know what can't be done. What can't be done is the way the Democratic leadership in Congress is reacting at the moment. They're reacting like they were hit sideways on the side of the head, and they're just stumbling around in a sort of daze. Well, yes, they were hit sideways in November of 2024. They had 10 weeks to recalibrate afterwards and to work out an effective opposition, and they need to be making that effective voice. They need to be doing everything they can, not just to sort of symbolically vote no against nominees. They need to be gumming up the works here. They need to be doing what the Republicans did when they were in the minority, when they went out of the way to filibuster, they went out of the way to gum up the works.
Yes.
Damn it, do the same now. If this is a constitutional five-alarm fire, and everything is on the line here. The Congress is being eviscerated. The power of the purse is moving from the legislature to the executive. The Trump administration is at the very least flirting with, and in some cases, actively disobeying federal court orders. The federal payment system, which is really the piping of how government works and interacts with citizens, has been hijacked by Elon Musk and a sort of gang of 20-something-year-old computer hackers. I mean, right. If this isn't an emergency, I don't know what is. It makes all of the ghastly actions of Trump 1.0 look like milquetoast. This is autocracy run amok. And, you know, autocracy in and of itself is bad. We're a constitutional system. We don't run on autocracy. We don't govern by ignoring the legislature, and we don't govern by doing executive orders to try and overturn constitutional amendments, all of which Trump is doing. But in addition to that, it's an emergency because it is so destructive of the way that government is interacting with citizens. If you go culling the federal workforce in the way that Trump is doing, you are going to eviscerate the ability of the government to collect taxes. You are going to eviscerate the ability of the government to ensure workplace safety. You are going to, as we saw the other day when they accidentally fired their nuclear safety team, you are going to really, really endanger public safety on everything from nuclear weapons to chemical plants to meat safety at meat processing plants. Now, again, we may luck out and nothing bad may happen, but we're playing Russian roulette here.
Yes.
And
yes,
every single day that these sort of arbitrary DOGE mandated cuts are allowed to continue, every single day that federal income streams are disrupted, every single day that grantees who have already signed contracts with the federal government are denied the money that they've already been promised, that is a breakdown of the government compact with the people. At the most fundamental, basic of ways, the government is reneging on its most basic obligations to the American public. And you know, this to me is a scandal that Congress isn't doing more. It shouldn't just be the Democrats. This should be a bipartisan issue. Trump, every single day of the last month, every single day, if you go down the list of things Trump has done, you will find at least one thing that is an impeachable offense.
Yes.
And there isn't a whisper in Congress about reining Trump in. The Republicans think that they can ride this tiger. They should bear in mind what John Kennedy said. You ride the tiger, you end up in the belly of the tiger.
Yeah. Yes. Oh, but, you know, the people are trying. Around here, we had a big rally, and all across the country, we had rallies. Not sure that did anything. Chuck Schumer reads from his piece of paper. I'm not sure that does anything. We don't quite have the votes in Congress, but like you say, gum up the works. And you know, the other thing I worry about is all of these suspensions, offers to retire, and so forth. You're losing people who know how things work and how to make it function. I was just talking to a fellow from NOAA today, but any of the federal agencies, including the IRS, the expertise is being lost. They just cut the new hires or cut. Are encouraging old people who know the most. I'm in the computer industry. The ones who know the most are the most valuable because it's very complicated. So I'm worried about the loss. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are two things. It's happening at both ends of the spectrum. So you're absolutely right. An awful lot of the most senior people with the most knowledge are either being forced into retirement or they're taking the honorable course of resigning rather than, you know, doing what Trump's mandating they do. So you're seeing top prosecutors who say, absolutely not. I'm not dropping the charges against Eric Adams. I'm resigning. It's a matter of dignity. You're seeing the head of the Social Security Administration saying, look, I can't give these hackers access to every single person in America's lifetime earning statements and Social Security. It's, you know, wrong and it could, you know, be used for all kinds of nefarious ways. I'm resigning. So at the top tier, you're getting good people with knowledge forced out. But the other thing is, the way they're doing these cuts, they're basically going after everyone who's quote-unquote a probationary hire, someone with less than 2 years of experience. What they're doing is they're culling an entire generation of young people as they enter the workforce. Well, if we have no incoming civil servants, how will government function in 10 years or 15 years when an entire generation has either been fired from civil service or they've looked at what's happened and said, I'm absolutely not going to go into government service because the government is an unreliable and oftentimes sadistic employer. And you look at what's happened with the firings. They have been carried out in the most impetuous way, dishonorable way. People getting emails in the middle of the night, people landing from work flights to find their phones have been disconnected, people getting no severance pay, people losing access to health benefits immediately. This is the most dishonorable way to treat public civil servants one can possibly imagine. It's also extraordinarily dangerous. If you think back to what happened when the Soviet Union imploded in 1989 to 1991, the Soviet Union was a great bureaucratic system with a lot of experts, with a lot of knowledge of a whole bunch of things from nuclear weapons all the way through to, you know, foreign policy, whatever it might be. When the Soviet Union imploded, you had an awful lot of people with marketable skills who had no income, and they were snapped up by mercenaries, by gangs, by arms dealers, and everything else. It's a really, really dangerous thing to do, to eviscerate the civil service this way and to humiliate people with the kind of knowledge that people in the Nuclear Safety Administration, for example, have. And yet this government is going out of its way to do that. Well, if you do that, you are going to get blowback eventually, and it's going to be dangerous and it's going to be unpleasant. And it's entirely predictable, which is another reason it is so utterly stupid. And again, I know I'm speaking to an audience in Florida. A lot of you guys voted Republican, I assume.
Oh, yeah.
You may have voted Republican, but do you really want the Nuclear Security Administration firing safety crews? Do you really want chemical weapons experts no longer having income and, you know, maybe ending up farmed out to the highest bidder? I don't care whether you're Democrat or Republican. That's just really, really counterproductive, dangerous politics.
Well, I worry about those people. Someone will be snapped up by consultants and sold back to the United States for twice the price.
That's the least bad option. But yes, that could easily happen.
Okay. I'm going to leave it there. My mic is not. Hello, dadgummit. I'm going to leave it there and talk to Carol Lerner, Carol Lerner is in the studio now. She's a Sarasota activist and a friend who's been on Peace and Justice several times. She founded POPS, Protect Our Public Schools, and she's later merged with Support Our Schools, another group with similar aims, and she's a director there. Their website is supportourschools.com. So welcome, Carol. There was a big rally yesterday at the school board, and yes. I want you to tell us all about it, what happened, and what the upcoming actions or directions are of your group.
Great. Thanks, Tom, for having me today. Yes, I'm very much fresh from 2 days of rallies and activism in Sarasota. On Monday, we were part of the national effort, and we had about 2,000 people in Sarasota, which was terrific. And it was a 1-2 punch because the following late afternoon, and this is something we had planned at least like a full week prior, we had a rally at the school board, Sarasota County School Board. There's a big issue. It very much followed the rally of Monday because we're very concerned here in Sarasota, and everybody should be concerned throughout the nation, of what's going to happen to education. Probably most of the listeners have heard that Trump very much wants to shut down the U.S. Department of Education. Just the other day, he called that department a con job.
Huh.
Yeah. So we think he's the con. So what we really wanted to do was to educate the public and the school board, and we're hoping that the school board will join us as allies. Our rally was not in any way against the school board. It was to actually protect the students, families, teachers, the actual district from what might happen. Now there are a lot of questions about this. We're not saying, and hopefully it's not going to happen at all, but I think that hope will only be realized if people all over the place do what we're doing, which is to make it an upfront issue. At the rally, we had about 60 people, and as I said, we really just started this about a week ago when we started hearing all the details of what might happen. We decided to have this rally mainly for educational purposes, but we had a lot of new people. Some of the people that normally come were so exhausted from the day before that they didn't come and apologized. But we did have a lot of new people, including a lot of parents who are very scared. Now this is the issue. It's not just the possibility, the very strong possibility of the Department of Education closing. It's what that could mean for the two main programs that they fund. One is called IDEA, which is basically funding for special education. And in Sarasota, there's a total of about $50 million that's at risk that we get from the federal government, plus another $31 million for lunch and basically the free and reduced lunch program. But of the $50 million, which are for programs, 12.3 is for special education. That's the IDEA. And then almost the same amount, just a little less, 11.4 is for Title I. And Title I is a program, a longstanding program, both of them are, that gives money to schools where they have a large number of students from low-income families. So I calculated for the IDEA, which mostly fund, both of them mostly fund staff, but the IDEA in particular, that would mean about 170 teachers, they wouldn't be able to pay their salaries. That's,
wow.
That's huge, yeah. But not only that, it's not just the $12.3 million. If the Department of Education goes or is gutted, either way, it doesn't matter, people, students will lose their protections. There's an Office of Civil Rights within the Department of Education, and they process any complaint about a student's IEP if there's an irregularity. But they also are basically an anti-discrimination office too. So if people feel they're being discriminated upon for any reason, including all the Title IX discriminations, it's processed within the Department of Education. And that's already been gutted and made useless already.
Wow.
Tom, do you have any questions thus far? I'm talking a lot, so I
no, no,
I
no.
Don't know.
I don't,
okay, should I just keep going?
I think you should.
Okay, well, let me explain that a little bit more about this Office of Civil Rights. There was a really interesting article in the ProPublica, which I think is a great media source in general. And basically what that article, it was an article with different attorneys, all not speaking openly because they're the few that are left and they don't want to get fired, although the job that they're doing now is probably such that they'll probably all end up quitting. Because what Trump and DOGE, which has already basically taken over the Department of Education, they're literally holed up there, they are not allowing them to process any just normal type of claim. Instead, they're dictating what it should be, and they're also making them put on hold all the claims that are in process. So what they're saying is that they can only investigate a claim that has to do with transgender, like the bathrooms, transgender in women's sports. Mm-hmm. And listen to this. I mean, that's just horrible in and of itself. And only claims that white students have been discriminated against.
Sure.
And they have about 6 cases in total, and they normally have about 200 in the same time period. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so that's a terrible thing. Now, Title I, that funds whole schools in Sarasota, which is actually one of the wealthiest counties in Florida. But half of our elementary schools, and that's more like about 12, I believe, are Title I schools. And that means that they get, for all the students, and not all the students are going to be low income. It ranges from like in the 40% to some of them are like 90-odd%. But every student gets a supplement of over $2,000 per head. So that's a lot of extra money in a school. And that goes to reading specialists, math specialists, after-school programs, tutoring programs, parent education, just a whole array of activities that really does help to address any type of achievement gap. So that would be gone. And this is something, I'm talking Sarasota, I'm just giving you information on Sarasota. This will be every single school district in Florida, every single school district in the United States. If this happens, and I say if, because we're organizing, hopefully, education is a topic that people support. In Sarasota, for example, in our last election, and it was actually, it was the last election, 84% voted for a tax.
Yeah, that's right.
For education. Yeah, it was a referendum question that would sustain basically a form of a property tax, and 84%. So that was like all political parties supported that. A lot of people gripe about education, but when it comes to their neighborhood schools, they're almost all supportive. Almost everybody loves their children's teachers. So education is a very popular issue when push comes to shove.
So this is Carol Lerner talking from Protect. So support our schools. Support our school. Supportourschools.com. Carol Lerner, has any of this happened yet? And is it imminent? What are the cuts?
Okay.
What are they, and when are they happening?
Or, No, as I said, it's a lot of things have happened. I explained how this one civil rights office has already been gutted. A lot of people have been fired.
Right.
So those kind of things have happened. The funding, as far as I know, is still flowing.
Uh-huh.
But these are some of the clues that are not good. So we the nominee for Secretary of Education is a person who totally supports privatization.
Wow.
Linda McMahon is her name, and she'll most likely she's going to be approved. She's already had her hearing, and it's just a matter of the vote now. Her organization, she's the chair of the America First Policy Institute. They've done 300 executive orders. It was basically a front organization for Trump to prepare him for the presidency. One of those executive orders is to close down the Department of Education. So once she's approved, the word is that President Trump will issue an executive order to shut it down. Now, that doesn't mean that it's going to be shut down, because like almost anything, it has to get congressional approval. But that may not happen if you see how the administration is basically ignoring Congress, and Congress is kind of rolling over and playing dead on that. So who knows? But already there is an executive order for the two programs that I just mentioned, the Title I and the IDEA. So that's the for low income and for special education. He already issued an order that these funds that are now dedicated funding, so it goes to the state and then it has to be used for those purposes, he wants to put them into a block grant to the state. Then the state can kind of decide what to do with
that's
it.
That's bad.
And what this executive order says is that it should go for vouchers and charter schools and such, particularly vouchers to private schools. He's already said this in an executive order.
Wow.
This is why we're so worried. And as I said, DOGE is in there, pretty much taken over the Department of Education already. So it's something that everyone saw what they did with the AID, basically dissolved it. Something that they could do, and who knows, there'll be court cases, but some of them are stopping things. Some of them are stopping them temporarily, and then they go through. As I'm sure the previous guest said, I didn't hear the whole thing, but I would imagine he talked about that there being a coup in Washington. And that's what's going on. It's very frightening what's going on. So there are all these different clues about this happening. The other thing that happened, and included one of the leading Florida representatives, U.S. Representative Maxwell Frost. Maxwell Frost is this very young, very progressive, great congressman from the Orlando area. He and 12 others were locked out of the Department of Education when they tried to get in. Just to find out what was going on, and they brought armed guards out to keep them out. So this is serious stuff that's happening. Support Our Schools is a grassroots organization that was formed largely by parents. I am a retired educator myself. I'm sort of the grandma of the group. It's great working with younger people. But I'll tell you, in Sarasota, where there are a lot of retirees, our base is very much retired people. But we're bringing in more and more young people.
Good.
We're working with the Sea Alliance, which is a youth-led advocacy group, and the rally yesterday was organized by both of these organizations. So at the school board meeting last night, we had probably about 12 young people spoke from their hearts, uh-huh. Another six or so parents, one in tears, spoke from her heart. I actually had a kind of formal speech planned, but A, I forgot my glasses and it was hard to read. But I decided to speak from my heart, from someone who has dedicated my career was all in special education. So I know what it means. I've held parents' hands. Some of the parents have become my best friends, and I see their what were children when I worked with them now as adults. So I know what education can mean.
We're talking to Carol Lerner of SportOurSchools.com. So if you want to, Carol, if we want to keep up, we have about 20 seconds.
Okay.
If we want to keep up, we watch your website.
You're going to go onto the website
right.
and sign up to be on our mailing
right.
list. It may say sign up for the non-our mailing
right.
list. It may say sign up for the newsletter, but it's more okay. of a mailing list.
SupportOurSchools.com. This is